Welcome to Ambleside Flourish, brought to you by Ambleside Schools International. This is our four-part series on bringing up joyful children with Dr. Bill St. Cyr, Executive Director of Ambleside Schools International, hosted by Ambleside Schools of Colorado. Part 5, Questions and Answers.
But we can probably at this point, I can throw it to you and questions. Well, there's fear. So the difference between fear and anxiety, you know, the best things that I've read suggest that fear is a right brain emotion and it's more fundamental. Anxiety requires a certain way of thought. So when we're anxious, I've got a fearful emotional state, but I've overlaid it with a negative analysis of my position in the world. So with anxiety, it seems to be self-replicating. In other words, I experience fear, and then I'm thinking in a way that amps that up, and I get in this anxious loop. Because I start as anxiety almost always has a certain kind of self-talk going with it. That increases it. That's one of the real problems with anxiety is once we feel it, we tend to start thinking in a certain way that makes us more anxious, alienates us further, fragments us more relationally, which makes us more anxious, and you know it tends to be a downward spiral.
And your suggestion on getting out of the spiral would be all of these things, or is there
well, one of the best things to do, you cannot feel anxious and appreciation at the same time. I mean, if you want the kind of quick cheat to get out of it, it is impossible to experience appreciation and anxiety at the same time. So if you step back and give your attention to what I appreciate, and not just say the words, but allow yourself to remember what it was like to feel appreciative of some good gift. And particularly if you're anxious with a person in your relationship, if you can kind of step back and wait, let me remember who my spouse really is and some good time which I really felt appreciation of my child, my spouse, my teacher, my friend, then you can't sustain anxiety and appreciation at the same time. And interestingly, if you want, the thing is, well, what's the truth, right? The lion really is in the room and it really is gonna eat me. Well, actually, we're much more likely to get an accurate assessment of the truth of things if we're joyful in a joy-peace state such that our frontal lobes are working well than if we're anxious. Our anxiety at the end of the day never protects us because it clouds our frontal lobes so we don't think clearly. And there may really be something wrong, but I'm much more likely to be able to identify that clearly and see the way forward if I'm in a joy-peace state than if I'm in an anxious state. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's really good.
Yes?
I kind of have a question, and then I'm probably going to talk too much trying to explain what my question is. So, to grow the banana, is it that you just go back to deeper? Is it that you go to the definition of true joy? So you want to feel even like you belong to Christ even more, and you want to feel more secure in faith, and you want to feel.
Yeah.
Practically speaking, how do we grow our banana?
Okay. So the thing is, I mean, it's very interesting when a newborn enters the world, the back of their brain, the lower limbic system is fully functional. The banana is hardly formed at all. And the frontal lobes are just a mass of random neurons. I mean, and so the way the banana is shaped is completely relationally. I mean, it's primarily shaped by the quality of bonding with mom. And basically, a child's banana in many ways is replicating mom's banana. That's just how it works. And so, since we all have, grace to you moms, because I know you all have imperfect bananas, like all of us, right? So, like all of us. But what it does mean is we can continue to grow. But the only way our children's bananas can develop is by being in a bonded relationship with someone who's got a more mature banana than they do. We talk with our teachers about you must be the bigger brain. And the biggest brain of all is Jesus. And so one of the most fruitful things you can do in terms of this kind of development is learn to dialogue with him. Since when it comes to these kinds of issues, unless you've got some practice, most people aren't very good at it. One of the things I recommend is that you begin by journaling and journal like this, Dear Jesus. And then really tell him your story. I mean, really kind of everything that your crazy banana is saying, thinking, and doing. You know, tell him, write to him. And then after you've written to him, turn the page and go, Dear, and put your name. And then write what you think he'd say to you. And let him write back to you. And every once in a while, you'll write something and you'll say, boy, that's harsh. That doesn't sound like Jesus. And that's just your dysfunctional banana or the demonic. It's one of those two things. When you get, and just draw a line through it. No big deal. Just draw a line through it. When you write something that doesn't sound like Jesus. And that requires you to be like reading the scripture, so you're getting a better and better feel for who the real Jesus is. But you write, Dear, and then you write what Jesus said. And what it's interesting, what happens is, you know, you write a bunch of stuff and you say, that's pretty good, but was that me? Or was that him? Was that me? What's the deal? And actually, when two people are in a shared mind state, you can't tell whose idea it was. So you ever been in a discussion with someone where you were really synced? And when you were really synced, you know, out of this dialogue, some great idea comes and you can't really figure out whose idea it was. Well, that's because it was the function of the two of you being in a synchronized brain state. It wasn't one or the other, it was both. And so you'll have those kinds of, and then every once in a while you'll write something and you'll say, I would never have written that, but that is exactly what Jesus would say. And that's one of the best tools for maturing your banana that I know of. Because it can only be that and find people that have the maturity skills you don't. Own your own weaknesses. If you take the various kind of the six fundamental and painful emotions, just assume there you'll have varied degrees of proficiency. You know, if you don't do shame well, you really need to be in relationship with somebody that does shame very well. That's why the church needs each other. That's why we really, really need each other and need to be not just going to meetings together, but be in synchronized, attuned relationships with each other so that we can actually help grow up our bananas. Because lecture doesn't do it. It only happens in bonded relationships.
Relationships need to have a structure, or is it organic, just we're doing life together and something comes up?
It's pretty organic, it's organic, but there are certain steps to the dance. Like if we're working on looking each other in the eyes and smiling, if we're working on sharing our true hearts with each other, if we're working on sharing appreciation stories with each other, letting me know in a natural way what you really appreciate, and not just doing it on the side, but actually looking in my face and eye to eye, synchronized, connected. Let me tell you what I when this happened, I so appreciated the way you handled that. That, you know, that was so kind. You know, when my Labrador Retriever got outside, was running on the street, and you went chasing him, and you brought him home. That was so kind. I really appreciate that you're the kind of person that would inconvenience yourself that way to go do that for me. You see, that's part of the dance. And when you're engaged in that kind of a dance, and you're doing life together, then the opportunities develop.
Total sense. This probably will reflect my process that I'm going through and being a performance-oriented individual. My slant of view is one company is going to get the contract, one person is going to get that promotion. There is some reality of the only had 27 seats in this class at Harvard, and some of that, the balance of that, the health of it. I mean, I've seen in my life where when I've done that, it has worked well for me. I'm more mature, not backbiting, not backstabbing, etc. But what would you recommend for the next step in the reality of life with the perspective, very clear perspective of Scripture?
So there's two ways to two reasons for being faithful, and basically two fundamental ways to live. Fear-based faithfulness to the task, or love-based faithfulness to the task. Fear-based relationships, or love-based relationships. And you can't do both. You gotta choose which it's gonna be. Now, we all do fear-based relationships quite regularly, because we all got a ways to go. But we can, the question is, are we aspiring that everything we do would be for the love of goodness, the love of truth, the love of hard work, the love of fruitfulness, the love of, and then we abandon ourselves to God and let the chips fall where they may. So when I say that, if we would actually abandon the Darwinian paradigm, that is not an excuse for sloth. And sometimes people are afraid because that will then be indulged as an excuse for sloth. No, it's a totally different basis for living. And it's a totally different basis for showing up at the office and working hard and doing a good job. It's not fear. And then, in God's providence, we let the chips fall where they may, trusting that He's bigger. And He knows what He's about.
How do we help our kids do, and maybe anyone who teaches at Amherst can teach me this, help our kids do what they ought, enjoy. instead of
right.
This grumbling obligation,
yeah, and
or out of fear.
Okay, so part of that, you know, if the Darwinian myth is one of the great lies, the other is that fullness of life is found by doing what you want. I mean, that lie hits our children 100 times a day. And there are 1,000 ways in which we teach our children that that's important. Now, that, for instance, it's rather a mistake for mom to, in the morning, say, "What do you want for breakfast?" Because it, from the time they're 3, it builds into the child a certain kind of moral imagination and a sense of who they are and how the world works. And it says, my desires are what's the most important thing. And because mom Mom's love means mom is the desire fulfiller. I mean, can you see if I'm born into the world, I have no idea how this place functions. But if my desires, when I'm 18 months, 2 years old, actually, you know, kind of up to about 12 months, maybe 18 months, their desires really should be the guiding principle. So, you know, if they cry, you feed them. If they, you know. But when they're two, we should be breaking them of that. Begin the process of your desires are not the guiding force of the known galaxy. And yet many mothers and some fathers, out of the best intentions, if a child has a desire and it's reasonable, want to give it to them. That's rather a mistake. Because then they grow up with the sense of their position in the universe is that the universe caters to my desires. And when that doesn't happen, like if you don't deal with that between, say, 2 and 4, whenever you do start dealing with it, you're going to get anger. You're going to get frustration. What do you mean? The rules of the game are changing? My desires don't govern what happens? How is that fair? That is just not fair. And that's what you're going to get. Right? And particularly in a culture that reinforces it. I mean, every commercial you see has two messages. First message, you should have what you want. Second message, this is what you want. You know, sometimes it's simply have it your way, right? It's explicit. So this is a galactic realignment that we have to do. And it helps to say, you know, sit down when things are pretty good, not in the middle of an argument, not when things are actually good, and say, you know how much I love you. But beloved son, beloved daughter, you know, I've got some news for you. I got to tell you something. And, you know, I don't think you're going to like it. but it is the truth. And because it's the truth, I need to tell you. And that's your desires are not the governing force of the known galaxy. In fact, in the whole scheme of things, they matter about that much. And the sooner you accept that, the happier life will be. And it's true. Life goes much better when we own that, when it's not about what I want. And in fact, we would do well to drop that phrase from our vocabulary. I mean, if you drop, except when it's your birthday, if you want chocolate over instead of vanilla, that's cool. But as a general operating life principle, it's not about what we want. It's about what's good, what's right. So notice the difference between these two questions you ask your child. What do you want? Or what's the right thing to do right now? What's the best? I mean, even when we're engaged in day-to-day conversation with each other, I mean, 150 years ago, people did not talk like that. People were not saying, I want, what do you want? That was not the way the dialogue went. It was what's right, what's good, what's the best thing to do, what ought we to do? And if the dialogue of the home is what do we want, then the moral imagination is being shaped that way. And their belief, a whole generation believes that the most important thing is what they want. And yeah, when you try to do that seismic shift, you're gonna get pushback and there's no escaping it. But it's much better if you change your vocabulary, if you have the discussion, if you remember. And they said, but I don't want to. You know, I get that. But how much do your wants matter? Is it your birthday? Is it your birthday dinner? How much in day-to-day life do your wants matter? Now, what's good for you matters a whole lot. And I, as your parent, I'm totally committed to what's good, what's right, what'll bring health. I'll go to the mat for what's good for you. But what you want, about that much. Yeah.
Sorry. To add on to that, just because, I mean, I remember sitting in a parenting 101 philosophy thing with Harrison 6 months old and totally eating up this idea of if you do not give them choice, it will end up in rebellion. And that is what's being in all of our school systems, in all of our, I'm hitting it in Sunday school every Sunday.
And it's worked, that philosophy has worked so well.
It is hard.
No. But you see, I mean, that.
Like, it's hard to engage a kid who says, but what are my choices? And I don't like that choice. Uh-huh.
Your choice is to do what's right. That's what your choice is. I mean, Paul's whole understanding of liberty and freedom is freedom from, it's not freedom to do what you want. Heavens, it's freedom to do what is right. What's your choice? Your choice is to do what's right. Please.
How would you define despair and how do you do it well?
So despair occurs when you lose a dream.
When you lose what?
A dream.
Oh, okay.
In other words, I have a dream that, you know, for us, you know, a dream for both of us was that we would have children. Mm-hmm. And so that we didn't have children is probably the most painful thing of our life. And so when you realize that you're not going to have children, and there's a feeling of despair, right? It's the death of a dream. And to be joyful in the midst of it is that it can be good to be me here with you even when I'm losing a dream. It's not happy, right? But it's good to be me here with you, and we don't have to relationally fragment. Because, I mean, when those kinds of losses of dreams, how many divorces occur? When you've got major losses of dreams and despair, because we don't know how to stay good to be me here with you in the middle of it. You know, if this is the way life is going to go, I would want to be here with you and be here with Jesus and walk through it together. But if we don't do despair well, what happens is we isolate. And then we feel completely alone. And then the despair goes deeper and darker and deeper and darker because we're, not only have we lost the dream, but we're absolutely alone.
You know what would help us a whole lot?
is you know, if you would choose like a segment of the population that probably does shame worse than anybody else, and we really need them to do it better than anybody else, it's pastors. Because, you know, if a pastor could actually share, this past week, shame is what you feel when you were less than your best self. Shame is what we're supposed to feel when we're less than our best self. But we, of course, when we're less than our best self, put on a mask, fake it, deny it. Oh, it's great, praise Jesus. You know, write a story that says we didn't, that tries to justify and explain why we really weren't our best self, that under those circumstances, that actually is our best self, and it's really all cool. You know, instead of, because we don't do the shame well, so we gotta write a story that tries to cover it up. And we certainly can't let anybody else know that we weren't our best self, because, you know, heaven knows what would happen then. So if shame is we were less than our best self, and therefore that's what I feel, that's supposed to be, like, shame's supposed to be the warning light on the dashboard that goes off that says, you know, engine problem. It's the warning light that says, not your best self here, not your best self here. And so, you know, ideally, I can then connect with someone else in my shame, you know, because it can be good to be me here with you, even though I was not my best self, because you're not going to damn me. And I don't need to hide it from you. And then when I do that and we do it together, I learn how to do it better. And really, if anybody needs to be leading the charge on that one, it's pastors.
So, sorry, can I follow up? Mm-hmm. So, if you're looking in the population of, like, how are you narrowing in on someone?
Someone who can say, right. If they can publicly say, you know, I was not my best self yesterday. The way I treated my wife, I ought not to have done. If they can do that in front of other people and actually look peaceful, so they're not like, please love me anyway, you know, they're actually kind of peaceful. They're just peacefully real, and they're kind of sharing their pain at the fact that they were not their best. That's someone who probably does it pretty well.
And so you're saying a pastor would exemplify that from the pulpit.
That's right.
Admitting their problems.
Yeah.
And still moving forward.
That's right.
You can grow from that.
That's right. Okay. You know, I am not the perfected one up in front. Or teachers.
Right.
I mean, we actually train our teachers. I mean, or parents. I mean, you know, one of our maxims is a good save. Everybody will drop the ball sometimes when it comes to dealing with children. A good save gets you more points than never having dropped the ball. I mean, what happens if you were less than your best self with your students or with your children, and you, as soon as you come back to your right mind, frontal lobes turn back on, joy centers start, banana starts working again. You know, as soon as you're back to your right mind, and you go and you say, dear beloved son, dear beloved daughter, I was not my best self, and you really shouldn't be treated that way. Would you forgive me? I mean, does that increase or decrease your credibility with your students or your children? And you're teaching them a whole lot of skills when you do that.
Ambleside Schools International fosters an educational renewal based upon the pedagogical insights of British educator Charlotte Mason. Serving an international community of parents, teachers, and schools, Ambleside makes a living education accessible to all. A living education empowers students to live lives rich in relationship to God, self, others, ideas, work, and creation. For additional information regarding Ambleside Schools International and training opportunities for principals, teachers, and parents, please visit our website at ambleside schools.com.